Birds. You've caught the Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom, and Montana Public Radio. The Northwest Montana State Fair and Rodeo, state guidance on how to reopen schools in the fall, and the next installment of our series on the Little Shell Tribe. It's Monday, July 13th. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. The Gallatin City County Health Department recently detected a toxic algae bloom in a privately owned pond in Bozeman. Rachel Kramer reports it's the first one in the county this year.
Gallatin County temporarily closed a pond at Sundance Springs Subdivision Friday after test results came back positive for algal toxins, which are released by certain types of algae after rapid growth followed by decay. People, pets, and livestock that swallow or have prolonged exposure to these toxins may experience diarrhea, vomiting, convulsions, and death. County officials say harmful algae blooms at the pond near Sourdough Trail in Bozeman may have been the cause of a dog death Sunday. Hannah Riedel with the Montana Department of Environmental Quality says the state receives about 60 reports of algae blooms each summer.
So they're pretty common. It's much less common that there are toxins associated with the blooms.
Riedel says algae blooms are naturally occurring.
But they're occurring with more frequency and across a larger swath of the landscape. And a lot of that can be driven by things like nutrient pollution or warming temperatures and longer growing seasons.
The Gallatin County Health Department will conduct more confirmation sampling at the pond in Bozeman with guidance from DEQ and the Environmental Protection Agency. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
The Montana State Tribal Relations Committee is seeking public comment on 9 bill proposals related to runaway youth, motor carrier services, missing persons, and federal recognition of the Little Shell Tribe. Caitlin Nicholas reports.
Jason Small, a Northern Cheyenne tribal member and chairman of the committee, says that while some of the bills are focused on clarifying language, others could have a larger impact, such as a proposed requirement for trucks on reservation highways to use tire chains to lower accident rates, or a bill to provide resources for homeless minors during the pandemic.
What we're trying to do is find a place for these kids to go when they have nothing. We're trying to create them a little opportunity to stabilize their lives for a bit.
The committee will review comments and consider changing the proposals based on public feedback. Chairman Small says this is an important part of the legislative process because the public often has new ideas or knows of unintended consequences the committee may be unaware of.
One of the big things we hear about government is transparency, and this is one pretty transparent method for everybody to get an idea of what's going on, what we're trying to accomplish and do.
Montana legislature is expected to consider the proposed bills next January. Comments must be submitted by August 6th. A link to the legislative proposals and information about how to comment can be found on our website at www.ypradio.org. For YPR News, I'm Caitlin Nicholas.
Caitlin Nicholas is Yellowstone Public Radio's Report for America tribal affairs reporter. Organizers of the Northwest Montana State Fair and Rodeo voted Thursday to hold the 5-day event in August, despite a sharp rise in coronavirus cases statewide. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports the fair attracted about 15,000 people per day in 2019.
Nearly 80,000 people attended the fair and rodeo last year, which is run by Flathead County. Events with 50 or more people are allowed under Phase 2 of the state's reopening plan if social distancing is possible. Fair official Mark Campbell says social distancing and a strong recommendation for masks will be in place this year, though he says there will be no hard limit on the number of fairgoers allowed in at one time. Campbell says that number will be dependent on events and staff's ability to sanitize things like rides and tables. He says gates could close if social distancing becomes an issue as well. The county says it solicited input from the health department and others in making its decision to hold the fair, which runs August 19th through the 23rd. The decision comes as the state recorded 2 consecutive days of record increases of new COVID-19 cases. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
There are a total of 864 confirmed active COVID-19 cases out of over 1,700 total cumulative cases in the state as of Sunday. This means that about half of all COVID-19 cases reported in Montana are active infections. 29 people have died. Cascade County in central Montana has issued a public health order limiting indoor events to 250 people and outdoor events to 500. The Cascade City County Health Department issued the order Friday that also requires organizers of events with 100 to 500 people to submit an event packet for approval before the event can take place. The Great Falls Tribune reports that officials say the restrictions are reasonable and intended to protect the community from the coronavirus. Ground was broken Friday for a vastly updated outpatient veterans clinic in Missoula. Critics have complained that Western Montana's veterans have had to make do with an undersized clinic. As Montana Public Radio's Edward O'Brien reports, that's about to change.
At over 52,000 energy-efficient square feet, Missoula's brand new VA facility will be a much larger upgrade over the existing CBOC. CBOC, that's government shorthand for Community-Based Outpatient Clinic. The new David J. Thatcher VA clinic, named for the decorated Montanan who participated in the 1942 Doolittle Raid on Japan, will now have 154% more space than the existing clinic. When it opens late next year, the new $3 million center will offer primary care, mental health, and specialty care services. Montana U.S. Senator John Tester attended Friday's groundbreaking ceremony just east of Missoula International Airport. Tester, a Democrat, is the ranking member of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee.
It's been a long time coming, but it's good it's come. The veterans in Western Montana are going to be able to take advantage of this place and get the health care they've earned, and I think that's a real positive thing. I think it also helps from a recruitment standpoint, being able to get the docs, the nurses, and the management people we need here. So it's a win-win all the way around.
Montana's Republican U.S. Senator Steve Daines says Missoula's upgraded Thatcher Clinic will also be much more convenient.
For veterans to have to go all the way to Fort Harrison for care, I think the ability here to have this now one of the best facilities in Montana right here in Missoula, as well as the telemedicine capabilities, which is really important for our veterans, especially when you think of a state like Montana with the challenges of our roads and winter driving.
Executive Director of the VA Montana Healthcare System, Dr. Judy Heyman, says the new facility will provide state-of-the-art healthcare to Montana veterans. For Montana Public Radio, I'm Edward O'Brien.
The governor's office and the Office of Public Instruction put out two separate plans providing guidance to school districts earlier this month as they try to hash out what K-12 education might look like this fall. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports districts say both plans are by and large the same, but lack some specifics.
There was some tension between the OPI and Governor Steve Bullock's office before the 4th of July. Both put out guidance on reopening schools for district administrators and school boards to consider. Districts don't see the plans, which they say are very similar, as competing. They see them as tools to use as they chart their own course. But districts like Missoula County Public Schools say they would have liked more specific guidance on certain issues. Superintendent Rob Watson.
The health screenings is a great example. There's really no clear requirement to do a health screening in either the governor's plan nor the OPI plan. They recommend that you monitor students and staff for symptoms, but there's no specificity like when you should do it, how often you should do it.
Watson and his team have worked with the health department, but have also leaned on guidance from the American Academy of Pediatrics to make those decisions. Big Fork Public Schools Superintendent Matt Jensen has similar concerns on the specificity of guidance coming from the state. He says he would have preferred more concrete directives rather than broad advice.
You know, anything from face masks to social distancing to screening and temp check protocols. How many students can be on a bus at the same time?
Governor Bullock's office and OPI say districts should work with local health departments on specific questions, which districts are doing. Districts across the state aren't just sweating the specifics on masks and social distancing. Money is also a big concern, so says Helena Public Schools Superintendent Tyler Rehm.
There's a serious void there between what we're going to need and what we've received from the federal standpoint.
Rehm says his district received about $1.3 million in coronavirus federal relief funding.
I would expect our cost to be somewhere in the neighborhood of between $4 and $5 million increased costs for next year. That's personnel, that's transportation, that's supplies, materials, technology, etc.
Rehm says that money will need to be pulled from the district's limited reserves. Transportation is a particularly costly issue as districts work out how to reduce the number of kids on buses at any given time. Many are considering staggering start times, meaning more bus routes. Some are considering only bringing portions of their student population back on certain days. But that mixed in-person and remote model of education is also more staff intensive, which comes with its own cost. School Administrators of Montana Executive Director Kirk Miller says districts are also facing increased liability insurance costs as they could be held liable in the case of a large outbreak. He says a recent Association of School Business Officials estimate shows that across the board, it will cost more to educate students this upcoming year.
$41 million came to Montana, and that will serve about 160 to 170,000 students.
Miller says that federal relief funding would roughly need to double to serve that many students if projected costs fall in line with the school business officials' estimate. Additional federal relief funding is reportedly a part of the conversation as Congress works out another possible coronavirus stimulus bill. But in the meantime, Montana schools will need to look to their reserves to cover additional costs that go above and beyond what they have already received. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
Roughly 6 months ago, the federal government officially recognized the Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians as a sovereign nation. It was national news then, but what does it mean now for the members and descendants of Little Shell? Nine students from the University of Montana School of Journalism spent a semester reporting on the impact of recognition on what has long been considered Montana's landless tribe. This story is part of the student-produced series Project Little Shell.
From the University of Montana School of Journalism, I'm Allison Berrien. After the Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians got the federal recognition they've been fighting for over 150 years, a lot of people thought that would mean that the tribe would finally get land. Here's Colin Hill, the secretary and treasurer for the Tribal Council, who has an office in Great Falls.
We were under the assumption before that they kept saying through all the stuff we've been working with her, is that it was stated, you know, that the government would give us 200 acres. And we kept wondering, okay, where will that be?
The Little Shell have been known as the Landless Tribe, the biggest tribe recognized by the state of Montana that did not have its own reservation. So the land was the first idea the people went to after gaining that hard-fought federal recognition.
And come to find out is the government doesn't give us land. We have to go out and find the land and then come up with money to purchase it.
Chairman Gerald Gray has had to answer this idea about 200 acres, which is land that has yet to be designated or purchased and is certainly not outright given to the tribe. Here's Chairman Gray on the phone from his office in Billings.
The misconception out there was mostly due in part to the media, where they had stated that the tribe will get 200 acres. We don't get 200 acres. We have to purchase 200 acres.
The bill that passed granting the tribe federal recognition also stated that the Department of Interior must put 200 acres of land into trust to be used for a tribal base. For the tribe, putting land into trust means that they will not have to pay taxes on it. But the land at this point is just an idea, not a reality. The other misconception, he says, is that the non-existent land has to be all in one place. It just has to be in the Blaine, Cascade, Glacier, and Hill County service area for it to be included in trust land.
We're not all going to move in onto 200 acres. You know, it's just not going to work like that.
Chairman Gerald Gray wants to create a central location where members can come for resources.
It'll be a land base where we will be able to have a tribal office. I call it a complex. Someday we could have a trade school, daycare. We can have our clinic.
The media got some things wrong. And also, there's just a lot of confusing ideas out there about what recognition by the federal government means to its members. Terry LaRock, who until recently was the tribal office receptionist, had to explain to the members that they have to be patient.
So just trying to help navigate people through the process of the recognition when we ourselves aren't sure what's going on, because, you know, this is new to the government, it's new to us, so we're trying to navigate our way through it, you know, just as a tribe.
Yeah, so right now it's really slow process, but that's okay, because we don't want to rush it. I mean, we're, you know, literally, if you think about it, we're building a nation. So we want to take our time, make sure we do it right, and, you know, kind of, you usually get one shot at this, so we're going to make sure we do it right.
The tribe currently owns 2 acres at the base of Hill 57, which historically is an area members of the tribe have lived for many years. It's a big question if the Little Shell can acquire more land on or around the hill, but that's not the front burner right now for the chairman.
Falls probably about, right now, number 3.
In order to get to this point, the tribe needs money. They have yet to see any financial help since recognition.
We've received zero, not a penny from the government for anything. Nothing for health care, nothing for housing, nothing from the BIA, nothing.
It's possible the tribe will consider selling its current building. The chairman even mentioned asking its members to pitch in, but he does not want it to get to that point. Here's Chairman Gray talking in person with another reporter from the UM Journalism School. At that point, he was a few days into getting private investors on board to help his tribe.
And we already have a couple economic avenues that we're pursuing that were even before federal recognition that will provide the things that we need to do for our membership. And that could be even enough money to build our own clinic. We'll do it ourselves, you know. And that might be the best route too, because then the government isn't going to tell you how to run it.
From the University of Montana, I'm Allison Berrien.
Students from the University of Montana School of Journalism talked at length with Little Shell tribal members about what federal recognition of their tribe means to them. Here, reporter Kevin Trevlin introduces Dwayne Reed, the historic preservation officer for the tribe.
After almost 130 years, the Little Shell became a federally recognized tribe in December, but many cultural heritage sites were lost during those decades. Reed locates and protects them, including as a consultant to companies building massive projects, like pipelines, near traditional Little Shell lands. Several years ago, Reed found records of historic Little Shell villages that the federal government decimated in the late 1800s.
Well, I bought myself a 1996 Ford Econoline van, named it the Thunder Road, and I drove out into the middle of eastern Montana, woke up the next morning with my wife and kids, and we drove down into one of those villages.
This is the morning of what's called the Big Bend. Little Shell Tribe Historic Preservation Site Mapping and Inventory.
What we were listening to is digital audio recording of myself investigating two Little Shell cabin villages.
It is Saturday. I am here on the Milk River in eastern Montana on the High Line. There are teepee rings. There was very likely quite a large population for its time here. People, maybe not even for its time.
Words can't even describe it, you know, to be back in this place. It was just wonderful, and I could picture in my head the people running around and thinking about what they were doing and the drama of it all and the busying about, and men like Chief Little Shell and Louis Riel and Gabriel DuPont and my great-grandparents all living in these towns and these settlements, and it was almost like I could see their images like ghosts moving about, and I could hear in the trees like the sound of the leaves and the rustling and the wind. And
looks like there is a barrel for a stove, possibly. Somewhere the timbers are left. This one will be labeled Cabin 3.
4. indigenous people to do this work. It reconnects them with their culture, their past. Every time that I have to do discovery and go into our records, go into the field, I'm learning again. I'm memorizing more facts. I'm learning about myself. And if we're not doing this, someone else is going to. And are they going to care as much?
I am currently standing in cabin 2 on the GPS, and not much remains of the original building, but you can tell there was a monster of a midship home here.
To have these cultural sites, these archaeological sites, it's extremely important, especially for federal recognition, because it's like a court case. It's all evidence. And when you're like, wait a minute, and you start picking through the information and you start adding the physical evidence on top of the historical evidence, then you start making a case.
You've been listening to Dwayne Reed, Historic Preservation Officer for the Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians. I'm Kevin Trevlin.
That story is part of a series about the Little Shell Tribe produced by the Native News Honors Project at the University of Montana School of Journalism. It's funded in part by the Greater Montana Foundation. Listen for more stories tied to Little Shell recognition this summer. And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you, early birds, tomorrow morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Metal art call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.